the widow of the man who perfected the machine gun, founded the Hotchkiss School. A Lowell and a Forbes funded Middlesex. The DuPonts were the patrons of Kent. St. George's was underwritten by the Brown family, whose name graces Brown University. Choate looked to the Mellon family for generous checks. J.P. Morgan was behind Groton. Over 90% of the great American private boarding schools issued from that short period, just after Herbert Spencer's American visit in 1882, and just before the indirect edict to the National Education Association that it must play ball with the de-intellectualization of public schooling, or it would be abandoned by America's business leadership. Elite private boarding schools were an important cornerstone in the foundation of a permanent American upper class, whose children were to be socialized for power. They were great schools for the great race, intended to forge a collective identity among children of privilege, training them to be bankers, financiers, partners in law firms, corporate directors, negotiators of international treaties and contracts, patrons of the arts, philanthropists, directors of welfare organizations, members of advisory panels, government elites, and business elites. Michael Useem's post-World War II study showed that just 13 elite boarding schools educated 10% of all the directors of large American business corporations, and 15% of all the directors who held three or more directorships. These schools collectively graduated fewer than 1,000 students a year. More spectacular pedagogy than that is hard to imagine. In England, the pioneer feminist Victoria Woodhull published The Rapid Multiplication of the Unfit. And in the States, Edward A. Ross, trained in Germany, University of Wisconsin pioneer of American sociology, was writing The Old World in the New, saying that beaten members of beaten breeds would destroy us unless placed under control. They were, quote, subhuman. Ross was joined by virtually every leading social scientist of his generation in warning about the ill effects of blood pollution. Richard Ely, William Z. Ripley, Richard Mayo Smith, John R. Commons, Davis Dewey, Franklin Giddings, and many more. None disagreed with Ross. Morons were multiplying. The government had to be made aware of the biological consequences of social policy. But while beaten members of beaten breeds had to be zipped up tight in isolation, ward schools and neighborhoods of their own, watched over by social gospelers, settlement houses, and social workers trained in the new social science, a new American social dimension was being created from scratch, in which the best people could associate freely, could rear their children properly, could reap rewards they deserved as the most advanced class on the evolutionary tree. That was not only justice, it was prudent preparation for an even better biological future. The way the new shadow society, a universe parallel to the one everyone else could see, had to operate after it first constructed for itself a theory of establishment and a theology of caste, was by creating a new social structure, corporate in nature, in which man was progressively defined by those with whom he affiliated, his synthetic associational tribe, not by his independent talents and accomplishments. If these affiliations were only local, then status was correspondingly diminished. The trick was to progressively graduate to memberships which had regional, national, or even international status, and this associated prestige would then be transferred to the individual. What a perfect way of keeping out the riffraff and porch monkeys this would prove to be. It was no idle boast. Nor was the statement a simple expression of snobbery when John Lupton, the director of development at the Choate School in Wallingford, Connecticut, said, quote, "There is no door in this entire country that cannot be opened by a Choate graduate. I can go anywhere in this country, and anywhere there's a man I want to see, I can find a Choate man to open that door for me," close quote. The crucial variables in identifying the right people in the new exclusionary America no longer included high-profile expressions of superiority. What they did include were, 1, membership in the right metropolitan clubs, 2, an address in the right neighborhoods, 3, a degree from the right college, 4, a membership in the right country club, 5, attendance at the right summer resorts, 6, attendance at the right churches, 7, passage through the right private schools, 8, an invitation to the right hereditary association, 9, involvement in the right charities, 10, trusteeships, boards, advisory councils, 11, the right marriages, alliances, a social register listing, 12, money, manners, style, physical beauty, health, conversation. I've made no attempt to enter subtleties of gradation, only to indicate how the E4s behind public schooling and virtually all significant decision-making in modern American society created, quite self-consciously, a well-regulated world within a world for themselves. Provision was made to allow some movement up from other classes. Clubs, for instance, were also agencies for assimilating men of talent and their families into an upper-class way of life and social organization. If we are unwilling to face how very far-reaching the effects of this American establishment are to school children, there's just no good way to think about school reform. Darwin's evolutionary racism, Galton's mathematical racism, Maine's anthropological racism, Anglican theological racism, classism, all are deeply embedded in the structure of mass schooling and the economy it serves. They cannot be extirpated by rational discussion. These viruses are carried by institutional structures not amenable to social discussion.